Kay Jackson, Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, a Civic Media station.
CBS News Brief. Two Pennsylvania state troopers were shot this morning while responding to a domestic violence call. Authorities say a man shot and killed his neighbor, and when troopers arrived,
they were ambushed by several rounds of rifle fire from a position of tactical superiority.
State Police Colonel Christopher Paris says two hospitalized troopers are now stable. The Gifford Fire in Central California has burned in the wilderness near Los Padres National Forest, but now officials are concerned it's moving towards inhabited areas. CBS's Jason Allen.
The structures that firefighters are having to pay attention to now went from just a few hundred to more than 1,500.
The National Hurricane Center has updated its forecast for the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season. For hurricanes, instead of 6 to 10, we're looking at 5 to 9. CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson.
The peak of hurricane season comes in September, and we've still got well over 80% of the season left to go in terms of when we expect to see storms.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
The Brewers return home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers back home with the night off after beating the Braves last night in Atlanta 5-4 after sweeping the Nationals. Pat Murphy seemed stunned they were able to win three in a row in Atlanta against the struggling Braves.
They're not playing for anything right now other than they're just good players. And I respect their team a great deal. I respect the Braves organization, and to come in here is very unusual.
NFL, the Packers in their third week of training camp. Christian Watson continues his rehab after suffering a torn ACL 7 months ago against the Bears. How soon will he be able to play?
I mean, I don't have a timeline as of right now. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, get back to feeling 100%, doing, you know, everything I need to do out there, and then I'll kind of just let the trainers and everything, you know, as far as I've just been, you know, feeling really good. I'm able to keep on going out there and attacking my rehab, and oh yeah, it's been going real good.
That's Packers wide receiver Christian Watson. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Milwaukee's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Good on Kathy Hochul. Look, not a big fan of the New York governor, but I got to tell you, she nailed this one. You know, in talking about the Republicans' effort to redistrict in the middle of the century, of the decade, by saying, look, you know, this is a war. We're at war. That's why she said, that's why the gloves are off. And I say, bring it on. And look, good. It's about time. It's about time Democrats got a little steel in the spine, a little itch in the trigger, you know. Because look, understand, Republicans are out right now to destroy every Democratic norm. They are shattering every bit of institutional stability that we have seen over our lifetimes. And understand, this is just one more in that. So yeah, what the heck? We're going to redraw the districts in the middle of the decade so that Trump can have the permanent majority he's been dreaming of. So this is one of those moments where Democrats really haven't had a choice. But I'm glad that they do, because they can't sit on their hands any longer and hope that the best will come as we've done in the past. And understand, you know, gerrymandering, not just one of those weird little words we learned in high school that you go, oh, I wonder what that. No, it's a direct attack on we, the working people of this country, plain and simple. Bottom line, that's it. The more they rig the districts, the more they rig the maps, the more folks like you and me, regular, average, everyday working people, have our voices squashed in Washington. when you have fewer competitive districts. And this is why I said, look, I'm not against gerrymandering if the goal is 50-50 districts, to where you now have to compete to move the needle one way or the other, instead of, like, we know who's going to win most congressional districts even before the first vote is cast. Because understand, this is how you get politicians who don't listen to working families. They only care about the donors and, well, the squeakiest of squeaky wheels. And they know they don't have to fix anything because, well, they just got to raise money. And it is why the anger is so high. It's why wages have been stagnant for so long. It's why healthcare is getting eviscerated. It's why retirement security is gone. It's why basic needs of everyday Americans get ignored while we get tax breaks for the rich. We have a government of, for, and by the CEOs and the bosses, and not we, the working people. And understand, this is not new. It's been 30 years of Republicans and Republican legislature doing everything they can do to tap down the vote, to rig the system. And this is just, again, the next stage of it. From hanging chads through, well, computerized voter suppression. The question is, will we continue to put up with it? How long will working people say, yeah, it's okay, while fighting over bathrooms or who dresses however they dress? We're fighting over stuff in the grand scheme of things that don't really matter while they are burning the Constitution right in front of us, while they are destroying the institutional norms that made this country great. And they hope that you're going to sit by and, well, and not pay attention. Question is will we? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is this just one more in the long list of attacks that are going to happen? Or do you think Democrats got a shot? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about for weeks now, you're watching the Trump administration slash budgets, the mass firings that have happened and are coming, and all of the assaults on, well, we're going to deregulate everything. And what's that going to mean for workers' rights, safety, all of that, as we're watching them gut OSHA, the EEOC, the NLRB, all those things that most people never really thought about because we got lives. But now that they're under assault, now it's kind of like, well, wait a second. Shouldn't we have that? Isn't this something we should want? And here to share some thoughts on where we are and unfortunately where we're heading, I've asked Jennifer Shearer to come talk with us. She's the Deputy Director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network there at the Economic Policy Institute. You can check out their website, epi.org. Jennifer, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I'm really happy to be here, although not so happy about the news that we're having to share with our network of groups all over the country. We are absolutely facing a dire U.S. worker rights crisis. As you noted, not that things were perfect before January 2025. You know, we were already in a situation where our country was lagging behind much of the rest of the world in terms of basic workplace protections and rights and standards. But we're now in a situation where the Trump administration has committed from day one to essentially an all-out campaign to roll back most of the 20th century and really return us to an era when workers have no rights and there are essentially zero prohibitions on exploitative employer practices, no matter how extreme they might be. Yeah. So, you know, I work as part of our state policy team, and part of what we are doing is in coordination with all the fine folks at EPI, Economic Policy Institute, who are tracking really closely what is the administration doing, making sure that people on the ground understand the threats, first of all, like what is already being rolled back, what is being ripped, you know, out from under our feet, and what is already on the list. The administration in July submitted, you know, over 60 proposals to change regulations, most of those health and safety regulations, but also things that affect people's pay. And what we already know was documented in Project 2025 far before the election, right? They are following that roadmap. They have been clear about what their agenda is. And so helping people understand how big the threats are, and most importantly, how states have to respond and should respond and can respond.
And thank you for being here. That was great. You wrapped up the whole interview, every question I had in one answer. No, but honestly, you're absolutely right. They want to roll back the 20th century, take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s. And honestly, they did. They wrote all this down. So when people say, well, you know, Jennifer, this isn't what we voted for. It kind of is. This is kind of exactly what they voted for because, you know, we knew.
Yeah, and I think they've made good on the promises so far. And so we have to anticipate that even some of the more extreme things that are listed in Project 2025 that they have not gotten around to yet may yet come to pass. So, I mean, for starters, the administration has already, you know, attempted to strip union contracts from over a million federal employees, made the National Labor Relations Board essentially inoperable by illegally firing one of its members, and now is moving to try to appoint attorneys from some of the most extreme anti-union, union-busting law firms to those open positions, so that when the board does become operable, it will not be fulfilling its mission, which is protect the rights of workers to unionize. The administration has already lowered pay for federal contractors around the country, affecting hundreds of thousands of people, closed 11 OSHA field offices in states that really need that capacity because they've got significant, you know, issues with workplace health and safety violations, closed 34 mine safety health administration offices out in the field, essentially eliminating, you know, cutting the majority now of the staff at the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. I mean, you could go on and on with this list. That flurry of regulatory proposals that they issued just at the beginning of this month, you know, is a scary list of rolling back mostly health and safety standards, like rules right now that are in place to limit workplace exposures to chemicals we've known for a long time are deadly. You know, why are we in the 21st century even entertaining the idea that somehow it would now become okay for workers to be exposed to things like benzene, lead, asbestos, cotton dust? I mean, truly, this is just it's hard to even fathom that this clearly, is the agenda.
Clearly, they don't care. Clearly, they don't care that they're making black lung great again. Clearly, they don't care about working families. I mean, you go through all the things that you've talked about and much more that they've done. It's very clear. But my problem is, yeah, we knew all this was coming at the federal level. But what I think a lot of people really weren't thinking about was the trickle down effect and how this was going to, you know, find its way to states across the country. So as we're looking at the federal government and the rollbacks that they've done, the deregulation and the numerous executive orders, you know, it has affected workplace rights. It has affected workplace safety on the federal level. But what's it done to the states, and what can people be paying attention to in states, especially red states across the country?
Yeah, I think everywhere across the country, states have obligations and even opportunities right now that this crisis is opening up. So for one thing, states are going to have urgent obligations to shore up a lot of basic labor standards that maybe most of us have been relying on the federal government to maintain. And that's everything from assuming that there's going to be a minimum wage in place and that it's going to be enforced in every state, because the federal government since 1935 has had that role, right? It includes things like child labor laws. We've seen this for at least 5 years running now. An orchestrated industry-driven campaign to try to roll back child labor standards, and they're trying to do that at the federal level now. So states have had to step in, and I think we've learned a lot from that fight even before this year. We've got states all over the country who have stepped in and taken a look at their state codes and said, okay, if the federal government isn't going to be a solid floor for some of these protections, we can shore up our standards. The other reality is that even before this year, there were all kinds of gaps and weaknesses and exclusions in our federal labor and employment laws. States have for a long time been on the leading edge of closing those loopholes, raising pay. So, I mean, I think a lot of people know the minimum wage federally hasn't been raised since 2009. Who has been filling that vacuum and making sure that wages in some states are keeping up with the cost of living? State governments and local governments. So we have lots of policymakers around the country who are experts on leading the way on this. We have opportunities for other states to learn quickly from them, to catch up and make sure that workers are protected in their jurisdictions while we're at a moment where, right, frankly, workers cannot depend on.
Yeah, a lot of states have raised the minimum wage, just not Pennsylvania. Can't seem to get that done. But here again,
keep working on it.
Of course. But, you know, the sad reality is we're in this bizarre kind of divide where everyone agrees the minimum wage should go up,
yeah,
but there doesn't seem to be the political will. You talk to the people, people say, yes, people should be making better wages, better hours, conditions, all that. But, you know, our political divide, because, you know, I'm looking at what Trump is doing. I'm looking at what the Republicans are doing, not just on the federal level, but across the country. And I've had people go, are we ever going to be able to roll that stuff back? Are we going to be able to ever undo it? And that's a real concern. I think the Republicans have done a great job of chipping away at our labor laws and ossificating it and doing all the things that they've done over the last 50, 60 years. It's just that the pendulum doesn't seem to swing back. Do you have any hope that maybe it does?
Well, I have all kinds of hope that it already is in many ways, in the sense of how these things are playing out on the ground. So these are, as you just noted, right, these are political fights in which people have to figure out how to build enough power. And in unique contexts, that power can come from different places and different configurations of organizations getting together. You know, we had three states just last fall, for example, where because state legislatures were refusing to take action on the minimum wage or paid leave, you know, big priorities that we know are hugely popular in every state across the country, but the Congress has failed to act on, people took it to the ballot and those ballot measures succeeded. And then, lo and behold, despite big majorities of voters in Alaska, Nebraska, Missouri, or the examples I'm talking about, saying, we want paid leave, paid sick leave. And in some cases, there were minimum wage increases folded in as well. Their state legislatures then reconvened and said, we think we're going to roll these back or try to weaken them. Or in the case of Missouri, just try to wipe out the paid leave provision. And people are now going to have to, in those states, do the next round of responding. You know, I think we've got examples of states like Utah, where that's happening right now as well. You know, the state legislature convened, and despite enormous public opposition, the state legislature passed a bill to ban public sector collective bargaining in the state. I mean, they don't have a strong collective bargaining law to begin with in Utah, but this was going a step further and saying, we're going to make it illegal for you to have a union contract if you are a teacher or a law enforcement officer, a firefighter. So citizens responded by, within weeks, collecting over 300,000 signatures to put that on the ballot and to block that from taking effect. So my point is, you know, we've got all kinds of signs and signals that the vast majority of voters, no matter what state you're looking at, are very interested in not only maintaining the basic minimal rights and protections that they've assumed would be in their workplaces for a long time. Most people are interested in expanding on those and making sure that workers have more rights, not less. Now, how is that playing out in our electoral politics? That's a whole different question. And I know a lot of other people, not my exact area of expertise, are studying why do we have that gap. But I think what we're really focused on right now at EPI with this these state level strategy materials is making sure that people, not, you know, like we talked about, know what the threats are and also look at the opportunities to focus on these core workplace issues that affect every working person,
right,
which we know are hugely politically popular, and make headway wherever you can. Figure out what your state's starting point is and prioritize those issues.
You know, at the beginning I said, OSHA and EEOC and NLRB and EIEIO and all these other names, most people don't think about. Most people I know don't even know what those stand for. But by having things taken away, and I think Americans don't like having things taken away, do you think there's a moment where there's an education component to this, to waking people up to going, hey, this is why it was there. This is why it was important. This is why we shouldn't lose it. Do you think that's being done? I know you guys are trying, but do you think that's being done, let's say, by an opposition party who might want somebody's vote?
So you're absolutely right. That is one of the things we think about every day at EPI. And we obviously need a lot more of that kind of education. I think you're right. These are, one of the realities is that because Congress has failed workers for decades, there is a lot of legitimate frustration about the mismatch between voters' expectations of where we should be as a 21st century industrial democracy in theory, that is advancing the rights of the majority of people and of working people. And instead we've got an economy where the gap between the ultra wealthy and most working people is continuing to grow. We've got a huge imbalance of unequal power between employers and workers. And so because we've had, policymakers failing to prioritize these issues for so long, you could say across the political spectrum, this is the crisis calls for people to refocus and think about the economy that we want to build and the policies that it's going to take to get us there. So, and I do think that, for us right now, states are, we've already got, piles of model policies from states around the country that have achieved, much better outcomes for workers. There are long lists of states that have room to adopt some of those policies and at the very least shore up rights for workers right now that are in crisis because of the federal attacks.
Because I get accused quite often of all I focus on are the attacks that are coming. And look, it's all about self-preservation in this moment. Obviously, the push for right to work laws, the push to end prevailing wages, and you go down the list, the child labor law assaults, the ending a lot of the protections in the world of safety. I focus on those a lot, but not as much as on what should be done to fix those things. And this is where Democrats, I think, need to take a moment and go, we should, even if it's not going to pass, even if it's just messaging, saying this is the world that we want to move to. Here's some positive. Do you see any states where there are those kind of pieces of legislation out there where people are going, hey, this is the world we want to be working towards? Yeah, we're getting killed here, but this is what we should be aspiring to. Do you see any of that?
Yeah, I think we see it everywhere. And let me toss out maybe a couple concrete examples to give it. Well, let me start with right to work, actually, since you raised that issue. We've really had a multi-year arc, frankly, of really positive state action on either resisting right to work attacks. No new right to work laws have been passed anywhere in the country for several years running now. And that's because voters have been clear that it is hugely unpopular So just this past year, once again, New Hampshire rejected a right-to-work proposal. Maine rejected a right-to-work proposal. Colorado is continuing to attempt to finally overturn their de facto right-to-work policy that was passed by their state legislature. It only didn't get enacted because their governor vetoed it. Michigan, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners already know, reversed its right-to-work law a couple years ago. So, you know, we're moving in a very clear direction, I would say, in terms of state policy on right-to-work. And it's away from more states enacting that versus the opposite, despite the attacks, right? I mean, the National Right to Work Foundation is never going to stop pushing that legislation, and the right wing, you know, employer interests that fund that attack is never going to stop. But in terms of actual state policymaking, people are refusing. And you could see, you know, Missouri was maybe the start of that, right? Their state legislature passed that. Voters took it to the ballot and said, no, we don't want to be a right to work state, right? And since then, we have not seen one new right to work law enacted anywhere.
No, and that's fabulous.
Just want to kind of lay that out, that's the direction to me that appears we're going on the state level.
And that's great. And that's fabulous. But understand, you know, 90% of the workforce in this country is a member of a union. And for them, they don't know what that means. What they're looking for are tangible things and how that's going to help them. Now, we talk about why union membership is so important and why having rights on the job and the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and a contract to end at-will employment and all that stuff, why that's important. But I think most voters have kind of given up on the hope for that and just like, hey, how are you gonna put food on the table today? How are we going to actually lower costs or raise my wages in other ways? For me, I want to see more specific, you know, raise the minimum wage, start taxing billionaires like we should be. There should some other things. Do you have some of those?
Yeah, let me run through some of those. And anybody who's interested in the minimum wage question, we've got a page on our website that tracks that very state by state and locality by locality. So if you type in epi.org minimum wage, you can go to a map and know exactly where we're at. So where we are is that more than half the states in the country have raised their minimum wages above the federal floor. And just this past year, Rhode Island just passed legislation to phase in $17 an hour by 2027. Virginia also passed very similar legislation. Again, the hang up there was that their current governor vetoed it, but that is an issue that people are going to bring back again. And they've got a governor's race in process right now that could change the outcome the next time. We've got places like Maine, where this past year, this is an issue that advocates had been working on and that farm worker organizations had been working on for years. The legislature finally closed one of the loopholes that is still with us from the racist passage of our initial Fair Labor Standards Act that excluded farm workers and excluded domestic workers, who at the time were largely Black people in the South who were not covered by our wage laws. Maine took the step that now many other states around the country have begun to do, which is covering farm workers with their state minimum wage, since it's not covered at the federal level. We've got a growing number of states. Georgia is the first the latest one that just this past year are taking steps to close another big loophole in our wage laws, which is the sub-minimum wage that some employers are allowed to pay to workers with disabilities. A lot of states, because of advocacy from workers with disabilities and their families, have recognized this is exploitative and there's no need for it, right? If somebody is putting in the same hours as somebody else on the same job, there's no reason they should be paid less than somebody who's doing exactly the same work just because of their disability status. So lots of states are closing that loophole. Like I said, Georgia was the latest one. We've got things like that happening all over. Paid leave would be another spot to look at.
All things that we could aspire to be moving towards. And I wish there were a political party that spent more time talking about that. I wish there was more attention paid to the things that we should be working towards, as opposed to just, now look, we got to fight the fights, but just focusing on that. just my thoughts. Last question I've got for you. If folks want more information on these kind of topics, where's the best place to go?
EPI.org. So there's anything I mentioned, plus lots more being documented there. And all the recommendations that we're starting to compile, and links to examples of great models of state policy that are already in place that others can basically borrow from and replicate. That series, we're calling it Holding the Line. We just issued the first 4 installments this week, and we're going to keep adding to that with other issues as the year goes on.
There you go. Jennifer, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great stuff. Thanks so much.
Yeah, take care.
Jennifer Shearer, Deputy Director at the Economic Analysis and Research Network there at the Economic Policy Institute. Just go to epi.org if you want to check out more of what they do. Want to hear your thoughts. You agree with me? Should we be aspiring to more? And should there be that political party that maybe brings it to us? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation. 540 WAUK.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy, warm and muggy tonight. Slight storm chance. Lows in the low 70s. Hazy, hot and humid tomorrow. High in the upper 80s to 90. Heat index approaching 100. 80s and muggy for the weekend. Scattered storms possible. It's 82 right now.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Actor Neil McDonough. If you saw his face or if you Google him right now, you'll recognize him. He refuses to kiss another woman on camera. On the one hand, I applaud him for not kissing anyone other than his wife. But she says, I don't have a problem with him if he wanted to kiss another woman. As someone who's done it, it doesn't really feel like cheating because there's people in the room. It's very mechanical.
You did write it yourself.
I did write it myself.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, Politico had a really interesting article that I think my red hat folks might want to know, because Trump's been running around saying we brought in billions, $150 billion plus dollars in tariff tax money that are supposedly going into the coffers, but Politico's reporting might have to pay it all back. Evidently, there are a number of companies and states that are challenging the way Trump went about this, the emergency law that he's using, that it could go to the Supreme Court, and they could have to pay it all back. So all of the prosperity, well, could evaporate. Much like all of the promises of this administration and this trade war. Look, I'm not an anti-tariff guy, but this trade war is kind of stupid. And the question, I guess, is his trade war destroying jobs here at home? Because the latest jobs number, not sure if you noticed, not really encouraging for Dear Leader's record, which may explain why he fired the messenger. And here to help us work through those questions and more, I've asked Natalie Baker to come talk with us. She's the Director of Economic Analysis there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Natalie, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be with you.
So there's the question. You know, since Liberation Day, how are we doing?
Yeah, so for those who missed it, Friday last week was a real warning sign on the economy. So we had some data that came out, and it was clear evidence of a slowdown, and it's a warning of things to come. So just to throw a few numbers at you. So for the last 3 months, the average jobs growth was 35,000 per month. That is really quite low compared to what we've seen in the past. So if we think about that number, 35,000 over the last 3 months compared to the last year in 2024, that average was 168,000. So this is really a worrying sign for jobs and the economy more broadly.
Lies. We've been 500,000 jobs a month. That's what we've been creating. You just have those Joe Biden rigged numbers.
So exactly to your point.
You don't know where to go with that, do you?
Exactly to your point earlier, this was a classic case of shooting the messenger. So the BLS, that's the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they are a high quality institution that produce great data. It's produced by nonpartisan independent economists. They've been doing this work for decades. And instead, when they produced Friday's report, as they have done for decades, this was a shooting the messenger case, and Trump said, "You're fired."
But should we be surprised? I mean, we're moving into this world of if dear leader doesn't like it, someone's got to pay. And so I know a lot of people were surprised, and I've had friends who, "Can you believe it?" I go, "Yeah, I can believe it." And I expect it to get much worse.
Yeah, and I think that's why this jobs report, it's a warning sign on the numbers side of things and what this means for the economy, but it's also a warning sign in terms of what's happening in the future and the future of these institutions. And one point I just really want to make here, Rick, is, if we think about the effect of economic uncertainty, this is just yet another case that we've seen where these policies are causing harm to consumers, to families, to businesses. And that uncertainty is really difficult to unwind.
So walk me through some of these policies, because, again, my red hat crowd, they're very happy to tell me, well, this is the Biden economy, and Trump hasn't, because Trump told us everything bad is Joe Biden's fault, everything good is his fault. So can you make that argument that, this is the residual of all the horrible things that Biden did?
Yeah, so this is where I'd go back to what the data says on this. So if we look at where we were at the end of 2024, in terms of the economy, we had decent growth. We had growth that exceeded projections over the course of 24. We had a strong labor market. We had good jobs numbers, and inflation was coming down. So if I compare that to where we are today, all in the space of the last week, we had a weak report on GDP. So that's weak growth numbers. When we look at what's happened in the first half of this year, you've got inflationary pressures coming about through the inflation reports that we're seeing, and particularly on goods that we might expect to be imported goods. So we're seeing some impact likely from the effects of tariffs that are coming through. So you add those things together, the jobs numbers, the GDP numbers, and the growth, the overall health of the economy, and coupled with the inflation, it starts to paint a pretty worrying picture.
So how much of this lands back into Trump's lap? Because I have friends who also were saying, well, that's just cyclical. This is just the economy. The president really doesn't do anything to create jobs. He's not really the guy who runs the economy. And my response to that usually is, look, I played sports for a lot of years. No coach ever won a game, but there were a lot of coaches who lost games by doing dumb things. That's how I see this, but I'm curious your thoughts.
That's exactly right, Rick. So, when we compare 2024, a really strong economy overall, a really resilient economy that we saw through the end of 2024, and then several deliberate policy choices by the current administration, all of which have pointed in the wrong direction in terms of economic performance. So I mentioned tariffs before, that's one of them. And it's the on-again, off-again uncertainty that creates that's particularly problematic. It's harder for businesses to plan their inventory. How do they set prices in the context of those prices changing? So all of that contributes to this uncertainty. The other point I just want to touch on there as well is if we think about this recent budget bill that was passed, this one, big, beautiful bill, if we think about the effects that's going to have on the future, the sort of Congressional Budget Office is sort of the independent nonpartisan assessor of these things, and the picture is not good there either. So you've got multiple policy settings, this sense of economic uncertainty and chaos, all of which is feeding through in sentiment, consumer sentiment, how people feel about the economy. It's just that now we're also starting to see it in the hard data.
So if I'm hearing you right, and maybe I'm just putting words in your mouth, am I hearing that things are going to get worse?
That's exactly right. So when we looked at what the projections from economists were about how the economy was going to go in 2025, Things were looking good. Those forecasts have often been revised down, you know, over the course of this year, whether it's sort of investment bankers or economists, other folks who really look at the numbers on this. We've seen consistently that those projections have been revised down. And a lot of that, again, is hinging on this uncertainty around tariffs and the global impacts that those will have.
Because we really don't know what we hear a lot of stories. And the one thing I give Trump credit for, he really knows how to ramp something up. He knows how to take advantage of it from the PR standpoint. He knows how to get attention. Details, I don't think that's his suit. But as long as he gets a headline, I don't think he cares. This seems a lot of that, because I keep hearing people going, well, this isn't what we voted for. I'm coming back to, no, I'm going to call, you know, nonsense. This is kind of what everybody who voted for him voted for.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously there's always big flashy statements. But what we care about is the facts and how that's affecting people on the ground. And so, you know, sometimes we can talk about big numbers in the economy and it's hard to parse out what that actually means. But, you know, if we think about what's happening to everyday people, less jobs in the economy, that's going to flow through. You know, we're seeing spikes in youth unemployment. It's harder to get a job these days. And that tight labor market, you know, trying to get that first foothold is really difficult. So if we think about how some of these big choices are actually affecting people on the ground, it's pretty concerning.
Now, the jobs numbers you talked about, you know, is it shocking that we would have such poor job numbers, given the fact that they're pulling a bunch of federal employment, they're pulling a bunch of money back? I talked to my building trades friends who were saying, you know, they're gutting some of the investments that Biden was making into infrastructure. Is any of this surprising? Because, you know, I've had people say, well, you know, there's partisanship in these places and, you know, they just don't like Trump. I'm going, no, there are actual hardcore policy choices that they've made that have pulled back government funding, which is a huge driver of our economy, which I think created this. Clearly, you're the economist person here. Am I anywhere near the right spot?
That's exactly right. So what we saw in this jobs report, you know, in addition to the sort of soft headline number, you see specific industries have been impacted. So, you know, since April, when the Trump tariff sort of Liberation Day announcement happened, there's been 37,000 jobs lost in manufacturing alone. And also big job losses in federal employment. So that's no surprise. And what often happens with these things is you see early signs in the sentiment data, surveys of businesses as they're making those decisions, consumers as they're deciding how to spend for the year. But now it's flowed through to the hard data as well. And so I think it's likely, you know, this is just one set of data. We'll have to wait for more, but it's likely that we'll see a really softening economy in the second half of the year.
Yeah, I'm feeling really liberated. I know a lot of people are liberated out of their jobs, which I don't feel is overly liberating because, you know, as you pointed out, the one big nightmare bill that they passed has a lot of cuts to the social safety net that would help folks who are losing their jobs. So it seems like they've put us in a direction, and maybe you can talk to this a little bit, that they're moving us in a direction to create even more desperation out of the desperation that they're causing.
That's exactly right. So if we look at the one big beautiful bill, you know, you've got major tax cuts that disproportionately go to the wealthy, and you've got major cuts to really critical social programs, social services, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's food assistance and the SNAP program, which disproportionately benefit low-income folks who need a hand up. So this is a really regressive bill when we think about it in totality, and it has little to no economic gain, according to the independent analyses.
But we're told, you know, I'm sorry, Natalie, we're told that those tax cuts, that's going to be what's going to jumpstart our economy. This time it's going to work. They promised.
Yeah. And again, I go back to the data there. So, you know, we look at what the independent Congressional Budget Office says on expectations for growth, and it's very weak. So, you know, we think about corporate tax cuts or individual personal tax cuts for very wealthy folks. It's not a good picture in the way that this is structured in that bill.
Is there a way to turn this around? Is there a way Trump can salvage this? Now, I think he's so into this tariff game that I don't think is going to work. And I said it from the beginning. I think what he's going to do, ultimately is screw up the idea of using tariffs, which I am in favor of strategically as part of an overall strategy, not as a bludgeon or the only tool in the box. But I fear that he's going to do this so badly that we never use that tool again. I'm curious, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just go back to what's happening in terms of business and consumer decision making and how hard it is to plan when you've got this on again, off again tariff situation. So in those situations, I mean, it's no wonder that you're starting to see the kinds of data that we are, where businesses aren't able to invest. They're not making decisions to support, physical investments or hiring workers. So, you know, it's a pretty natural consequence. It's what a lot of economists expected. We're now just seeing that come through.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, you know, they brought in $150 billion. They may have to pay it back, but they brought in a whole bunch of money. This should be a good thing for the economy. No, we're shaking down the UK. Best deal ever. We're shaking down India. We're shaking down the globe. This should be great. No?
I think the sad reality is that in the long term, it's Americans who will pay the cost of these tariffs in the way that they're designed, because they're blunt, they're broad, and they're constantly changing. So, it's the sad of it, but unfortunately, in the long run, what we probably will see is price increases that are disproportionately borne by Americans right here at home. So
last question I've got for you then, because, you know, I don't think most people have seen the effects yet of, well, the big, beautiful bill or any of the Trump policies yet. I don't think they've made their way through. What are we looking for in the fall and into the Christmas season? Is that when we're going to see things start to hit? I'm curious when you think public sentiment might turn in a direction that would be proportionate.
So I think, you know, different parts of the bill will come in at different times. So I don't want to sort of make a blanket statement on that. What I will say, the thing that I'm most worried about with this bill is that it could push up borrowing costs for you know, everyday households. So if you're a borrower, whether it's a car loan, it's a mortgage, a home loan, or you're a small business owner and you want to take out a loan, there is a risk that this bill, you know, in increasing the government debt, could actually increase your cost of borrowing. And that's what I'm really worried about in the context of what's going on, and sometimes gets missed in all of the kind of hurrah about this bill.
No, I mean, because, you know, we know Trump has a history of bankrupting companies. I know a lot of people who wanted the federal government to run like a business. My fear is just what you said, plus all of the other stuff that's piled on top of that. The goal here isn't really about raising tariffs to bring money in. It's all about bankrupting. And then, you know, kind of, I don't know what after that, but bankrupting companies seem to work for him before. So kind of got that feel.
Yeah. And if we look at the jobs numbers from Friday, and you've got a fall in manufacturing employment, it's pretty clear evidence that the so-called, you know, tariffs boosting this argument that tariffs will as they're defined, both support international security and they'll, you know, support local businesses. We are not seeing that yeah happen. Well, so
again, another con job, another sales job, just what we expected. But Natalie, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your expertise. I look forward to talking to you again really soon.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate your time, too.
Thanks so much. Natalie Baker, Director of Economic Analysis there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Want to hear your thoughts? Are you seeing the trickle-down effect? Is the economy getting better for you, worse? Want to hear it? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1890. That was the day that one of the heroines of the U.S. labor movement, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, was born in Concord, New Hampshire. Elizabeth learned her progressive politics at a young age. Her father was a socialist and her mother a feminist. Elizabeth was kicked out of high school for speaking out in favor of socialism. This did not slow her down. She kept speaking and her reputation grew. She became a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. She traveled the country organizing and speaking to workers. From the Minnesota Iron Range to the textile mills of Lawrence, Massachusetts, Elizabeth was on the front lines of the labor struggle. She was arrested for her activity 10 times, but was never sentenced. During World War I, Flynn was arrested and stood trial for speaking out against the war. The experience led her to become one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization dedicated to protecting freedom of speech. In the 1930s, Flynn became a member of the U.S. Communist Party, writing a regular column for the Daily Worker. But despite her personal political ideas, she supported Democratic Party President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944. During the 1950s, she was caught up in the anti-communist hysteria led by Senator Joe McCarthy. She went to prison for 2 years for allegedly violating the Smith Act, a law against overthrowing the government. She died while on a visit to Russia in 1964. More than 20,000 people attended her funeral there. A monument to Flynn stands at the Forest Home Cemetery just outside of Chicago, where she is buried alongside the graves of Eugene Dennis, Big Bill Haywood, and the Haymarket Martyrs. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, interesting situation out in Utah. The Salt Lake Tribune reported that last year, an 18-year-old from Utah was staring at the potential of years in prison, accused of having sex with a 13-year-old. Plea bargain negotiations were evidently at an impasse, according to the reporting. And then the Utah State Legislature, based on the initial suggestion from Senate President J. Stuart Adams, they changed the law. 2 months later, prosecutors offered the 18-year-old, who is not surprisingly related to Adams, offered him a plea deal. And that plea deal, no jail time, reduced charges, he's not going to have to register as a sex offender. It's one of those things where, you know, in Republican circles, it's good to know people, especially Republicans who are willing to let you out, let you go. Get out of basically what is in most states rape free card. There you go. Also, more fun with sex with Republicans. Republican Representative Derek Van Orden, he's a Republican in Wisconsin, evidently posted on the Twitters, posted a naked man wearing a ski mask, carrying a sex toy tied to a walking stick, and then said that it was another representative from Wisconsin, Mark Pocan. And it wasn't. But you know, this is what we're getting out of our representatives on the Republican side. Pocan did swing back, accused Van Orden of alcoholism, asked him if he was drunk again. And, you know, who knows? But again, we have our Republican friends who just, it is what it is. Also, Miley Biggs, she's the daughter of Republican Representative Andy Biggs, Freedom Caucus guy, or out, in, out. Anyway, she evidently is running for a seat in the Arizona Senate. Interestingly enough, she mentioned on a podcast last year, women shouldn't hold office. She doesn't think that women should run for office. She wouldn't vote, probably wouldn't vote for a woman running for office, but she's running for office. And it really does show the hypocrisy of those folks. Just kind of is what it is. And finally today, alligator Alcatraz. The story broke that NBC broke a story in Miami that it's basically a hellhole, which I know my red hat friends would be tickled by. They're the worst of the worst. But evidently no sunlight, backed up toilets, no access to showers, basic inhumanity. And in our name. And this is the place that Christy Noem, she says that it's the model for ICE state-run detention centers, Alligator Alcatraz, which they've made up names. They've made up signs that they've put outside because they're proud of that. It's their branding. It's what you expect from this administration. And now we find out, not just alligator Alcatraz, but there's going to be a Speedway Slammer in Indianapolis or Indiana somewhere. Maybe not Indianapolis, but she says we're going to go get the worst of the worst for this one. It's going to attain the worst of the worst. So what she means is, you know, the people who clean the hotels and do the construction work and, you know, cut the grass and do the work that most Americans don't want to do. That's who they're going to go get. You know, the worst of the worst. Which leads me to Kathy Hochul. Yesterday, you know, you talked a little bit about Kathy Hochul and the idea that, we need to fight. Started today off with her quote that we're at war. Agree. This is where she, again, not a huge, huge fan, but she's not wrong in saying that, up until now, Democrats have treated our political system like it's still governing by norms, guided by limits, rooted in fairness. She goes on to say rules were meant to be followed. It hurts to say it, but that era has come to an end. And it made me, when I saw that, it made me think, am I the only one who remembers the whole when they go low, we go high nonsense? And am I the only one who remembers all of the attacks I got from people when I said, no, when they go low, you smash their face into the ground. It's, you know, what I learned playing football as a kid. When they go after your knees, when they go to chop off your knees, defend yourself. Hands to the back of the head and into the dirt. That's what you do. And once you do it once, maybe they don't do it again. And if they do it again with the hands and then a knee. This idea that, you know, we're above the fray. And I remember the argument at the time of people going, well, you know, we're better than that. No. You shouldn't be, because you're going to lose. And understand, Democrats have been losing for a very long time. And it's what I've been saying of how they lost the working class. They haven't been fighting. Or the appearance is they haven't been fighting. They've been playing by Marcus of Queensberry rules, which, sorry to say, long gone. Maybe this redistricting thing, I don't know. Maybe this is that moment where Democrats have that, oh, yeah, this is it. We're kind of close to the end of the road, but I guess better late than never. So as New York, California, Illinois, other places are going, hey, you know, we're gonna think about doing this too. While personally, I'm not in favor of the country going in this direction. If they go low, You gotta meet them where they are. And as much as I hate the idea of doing this, maybe California, New York, Illinois, maybe those states, maybe you're gonna have to go that route until things get so bad that we're at each other again. And not in the way that we've been recently. We're literally tearing the country apart. And Republicans don't have a problem with this. They know what they're doing. The difference this time is they're planning on Democrats caving. They're planning on Dick Cheney, back when he was vice president, you know, was asked about, you know, if Democrats would surrender to what they were doing. And he's like, yeah, it's what they do. It was like, as a matter of course. Yeah, you know, they're going to complain a little bit, but yeah, they're going to give in because it's what they do. And to be honest, it's what Democrats have done for quite some time, all in the name of saving the institution. It's like the analogy I give. You know, Republicans come to the Democrat, go, we want to chop off both your legs. Democrats will go, can you just take one? And they go, okay, and they take that one. And then they come back the next day, go, you know what, we really want both. Democrats, how about just up to the knee? Oh, okay. And we slowly, death of a thousand cuts, we've gotten where we are. This is the take your stand. This is the stand your ground moment. Question is, will Democrats do it? And Is the game already so badly rigged that it really doesn't matter? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. What do you think? Is this finally it? Will we see Democrats with a backbone and a spine? We'll see. I want to hear your thoughts. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Firefighters are trying to gain control of multiple wildfires in California. The most significant is the Gifford Fire, burning in the central part of the state. At least four people have been injured, and more than 99,000 acres have burned across two counties. CBS's Jason Allen.
We've been watching as firefighters and sheriff deputies have been driving up and down the roads here. They have been walking up to the front doors, telling owners that they are now in a mandatory evacuation zone. If they leave, they may not be able to get back in. If they stay, there may not be anybody to come help them.
In northeastern Pennsylvania, some 50 miles north of Scranton, police say a woman was shot and killed by a neighbor as she walked to her car. CBS's Wendy Gillette also reporting.
Two state troopers, Joseph Parachinsky and William Jenkins, were airlifted to a local hospital after they were both shot. Police